I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As a society, we don't like to think about suicide or talk about it very much. It's seen as private or shameful. And to the degree we do think about it, we often see it as a choice of the young and impulsive or the old and sick. But a recent report shows that suicide among those in their middle years is on the rise. And that's what we're going to talk about today in our weekly Behind Closed Doors conversation. I'm joined by Dr. Eric Kane, co-director at the Center for the Study of Prevention of Suicide at the University of Rochester Medical School. Also here to tell their personal stories are Jim McNulty. He works with recovery programs at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Yvonne Smith, president of the Recovery Group. It's a mental health advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Hello.
Thank you
for the opportunity.
Dr. Kane, if we could start with you, a new 5-year study recently released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that the suicide rate among 45 to 50-year-olds increased nearly 20% from 1999 to 2004. Now, that outpaced changes in every other age group. Was this a surprise to you?
Clearly, when you get information like this, it takes your breath away when it's that large. And it's important to understand that actually the child data, which showed a modest increase, mm-hmm. but an important one, came out in September, and everybody was all over that in the mm-hmm. press within 24 or 48 hours. It was just the biggest news. But the adult data came out, and the difference is in the thousands. This came out in December, and it was a silent issue. Some of us saw it and paid a lot of attention to it, but it really was underscoring that in the middle of life, you know, after childhood and adolescence, all the way up to the later years of life, that there's something going on and that we don't understand it and that we better pay attention.
Is there any idea why?
It's really important when thinking about suicide to avoid a single explanation. Suicide's a punctuation mark that comes suddenly, sometimes at the end of someone's life, out of the blue, and other times it's a reflection of 10 or 20 years of downhill process. So it's very different there. It's just so important not to have some sweeping, broad brush approach that tries to explain everything at once.
Why?
Because take someone who's 42 years old, and a man or a woman. Well, as soon as you say 42 years old, then you can say man or woman. Things are different for men and women. Things are different for African Americans than whites. Things are different for someone from a Chinese background or an immigrant background. It's just very, very clear that suicide is a complex process.
Let's pay attention to some of the stories that we have here at our table today. Yvonne Smith, would you tell us your story?
Well, my final and last suicide attempt was when I was at about age 40. And one thing I can say, there's one thing for me, it's a feeling of hopelessness, a feeling that you have no choice.
Can you give us a sense of what the trigger was, if you can identify one?
Well, I was in a work situation, and there was some perceived work abuse. And then, of course, being African-American, we see a lot of this all the time. But it was a combination of a lot of factors going on in my life. I was seeing a psychiatrist. I was taking medication. And I was a lucky person, I guess, because I took a bottle of medication with about 6 or 7 bottles of beer. And that's typical for people, women who try to commit suicide. They will take something and alcohol may be involved.
Was it a prescription medication?
It was a prescription medication. I slept a good hard sleep. I hadn't slept in 4 days. I needed to sleep. I called into an employee assistance program on a legal matter, and I told them that, you know, I had tried to take my life. And so they proceeded to call my psychiatrist, who was on vacation. The backup psychiatrist called and talked to me, and he made me promise to come in that day to see him. But even after my hospitalization, I still had, you know, suicidal thoughts. But the message that I want to say is that people can get help. The issue is people don't talk about suicide. It takes a special cueing of a supporter or friend to be able to be open to that.
Jim McNulty, would you tell us your story?
Sure. I was also 40, as it happens, and it happened back in December of 1990. It was the result of the breakup of my marriage, and my marriage broke up essentially because I had manic depressive or bipolar disorder, but that had not been diagnosed. I'd been living with it since at least my college years. And for the period immediately before 1990, say for about a four-year period, I had really been struggling with alternating bouts of depression and hypomania. And I had been undiagnosed and untreated. So I had two young children, 9 and 4, and I tried to keep contact with them. And it was Christmas time, and I was homeless at the time, by the way. I had no home. I had no place to go to. I was staying with friends. And the kids needed a Christmas tree, and I had to borrow the money to buy the Christmas tree. That's how desperate I was. And after the expedition to get the tree, as Yvonne so pointed out so well, there's this just sense of overwhelming hopelessness and the feeling I felt like the world's biggest failure. Something else that I think is very common among people that want to take their lives is that we also think that the people around us would be better off if we were no longer in the world. I thought that my kids would be far better off without this failure of a human being as their father. I went into Providence and went under a bridge. It was it was a bitter cold winter, and there were actually floes of ice in the river. And my plan was to jump into the river because I'd read that dying in cold water was really quite easy. You just sort of fall asleep and don't know you're dying. I'm not sure how anyone figured that particular thing out and came back to talk about it, but I wasn't thinking critically at that moment. And a policeman had seen me, and two really, really wonderful people from the Providence Fire Department came and talked to me and convinced me that I really shouldn't hurt myself. And I have to tell you, there was a part of me that wanted to cling to life. I wish I could tell you that was, from that point on, it was a straight march to recovery, but it wasn't. And as I tell people, had I known how difficult the next 4 years were going to be in terms of recovery, I probably would have just stayed under the bridge and not paid any attention to the fire department and jumped into the river.
Oh, dear.
But, well, I think sometimes the fact that we can't see the future is really good, because I can tell you now that almost 18 years on from that point in time, I have a granddaughter. I'm extraordinarily happy that I'm married again. My life is going well. I do work that I think is important. I get to work with people like Yvonne, and Yvonne and I are old friends.
Yes, we know each other.
But there was a struggle. There was a long period of learning how to come to grips with it. And I have to tell you, it was every bit of 4 years before the feeling that I wanted to die left me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and we're talking about the increase in suicide among people in their middle years. Well, Dr. Kane, I wanted to come back to you. Obviously, there's been a whole lot of conversation about the baby boomers as a generation and how they kind of have changed the culture, been affected by the culture. Is there something about this generation that you feel may be leading to an increase in suicide? Perhaps is it more greater access to pharmaceuticals? Is there some sort of a consciousness about choices, perhaps less religious inhibition? What do you think?
Well, you're asking a lot of questions, which I think are going to be a focus of a tremendous amount of inquiry. The generation as a whole has been described as having a higher rate of depression, diagnosed depression, survey-based interview kind of information, certainly a much higher use of medications. So from that point of view, that is a warning signal that perhaps there's something different about generations. The second issue, we know that economic disruption is a very powerful force in people's lives. And for example, in the late 1990s, 97, 1998, there was a tremendous economic disruption in Asia. And this had an impact on suicide rates in Thailand, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, in Japan. My colleagues and I work with some people in Hong Kong, and it's very clear that subsequent to that, there were, you know, the suicide rate went up, particularly in people in the middle years of life, the people in working years, the people where they feel that others depend on them, where they have to carry sort of the weight of responsibility on their shoulders. And certainly our generation, I'm a baby boomer, I'm a similar age to I think your guests, and certainly it's been a generation of high expectation and high responsibility. So those sorts of big trends could have an influence. And when you look at the data that came out of CDC, there are some very interesting patterns there that should make all of us alert. One was that the suicide from firearms, which is typically the most common cause, went down somewhat. And it was strangulation and suffocation that went up and drug-related suicides that went up.
Poisonous. And by drugs, do you know what kind? You mean
well,
like
they don't have that data broken out yet. But certainly people thought about both prescription and non-prescription drugs.
So there's just a lot of questions we have. I mean, this is just the beginning, really, not the end.
Doctor, I just wanted to ask something. This is Yvonne Smith. I can only do things anecdotally. But also at that particular time, you have more people living further away from their family. You have to think about in my mother's generation, most people live within 30 miles of their mother, their grandmother, their cousins, their support system.
Oh, absolutely.
So in the 80s and 90s, you have people who, you know, they have brothers and sisters that live 100, 1,000 miles away. You know, you think about the grandmother that you could go to and tell anything, or the younger aunt who was in between your mom. She's not
there.
Who's
like an older sister, too. Right.
Right.
And Jim brought up how isolated he was, too. Social isolation is a huge issue.
Can I ask Jim this, too? Because you mentioned that, in fact, Yvonne, both of you mentioned that the people who were your first responders were very effective sort of at the time. But is there something that before you got to that point of deep despair that you think might have been helpful?
I have sat with families of people who successfully completed suicide, and there have been many attempts to outreach, including, you know, people saying, gee, nobody cares about me. And then, you know, the parents went to the home of the young man and listened to an hour and a half of recordings on the answering machine, you know, people trying to reach out, and yet the young man felt alone. I think the problem is, for some of us anyway, I won't say for all, is that the isolation is self-imposed, and we live inside our own heads, and we're afraid. I'm part of one of those families where everybody's 1,000 miles apart, so I had no access to any members of my family. So I was alone, and I didn't have the skills that I now have to learn how to do it.
To do what? You didn't have the skills to what?
To get myself through the bad period. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I know now when I start saying I want to die is I know I'm depressed. I know I need to do something. And I get in touch with my support system. I talk to my doctor, my wife. I let people know that I am starting to talk to myself about killing myself.
You know what I wanted to ask about? Does Dr. Kane, the data we've been talking about,
sure,
describes that the increase in suicide among women, 31%.
Right.
And the reason I'm intrigued by this is we think of women as being, well, how can I put it, less prone to social isolation than men, right?
More protected.
More protected, more likely to have a network, more likely to have good girlfriends that they
can go
to.
It's not the network, it's the loneliness.
I understand you, this is complicated, so I take your point on that. But so I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, what we're starting to see is that women are, unfortunately, I think, copying men. Women are drinking more. Women are using drugs more. Women are often more violent now. You know, you hear about women gangs or girl gangs that grow up. And so some of the things that used to be what we could call prohibitions or protective factors are starting to disappear. Also, I think the other thing that we have to understand and we're not sure about is, do the women who kill themselves in the middle years of their lives, are they like the men or are they different in some way? Maybe some of them are different. Certainly, a lot of them have been abused. A lot of them have come out of tumultuous life situations where they, too, as Yvonne described, came to a point of hopelessness.
Talk a little bit. We really are almost out of time here, but I did want to ask a little bit about race and if there's anything we know about the way race affects this conversation.
African-American women actually have the lowest suicide rate of all groups in the United States. even in the face of some of the greatest life adversity. And one of the, you know, there have been explanations like greater religiousness or spirituality or ability to reach out to friends and neighbors. African American men in the last 30 years, the younger men have started to look much more like their white male peers, with a tremendous upswing in suicide in the early adulthood years, and it tends to then taper off in the middle years of life, whereas whites tend to increase into late life. And so there are differences, but I think some of those differences are starting to disappear because the cohesion that was so community-oriented, and particularly the church is such a protective factor, some of that may be eroding. That's speculation on my part.
And some of it was probably underreported because we don't, African-Americans, we don't do that. That's you guys think.
Those people do. Those are the guys.
Those are the guys.
But as you have pressure and being able to reach out and people getting help, you're more susceptible to committing suicide if you have a mental health issue.
Jim, if I could get a final thought from you.
Well, I think one of the things that I would emphasize is the lack of effect that religion has had, at least for many years, and on my generation. I know that I was brought up Roman Catholic. A lot of my friends were. They left the church. I think that that losing that connection, that was a prohibition against suicide.
Okay. Dr. Kane, is there a final thought you'd like to leave us with?
I think it's really been important to put a light on this. You know, suicide accounts for more deaths every year than homicide. The bulk of suicide comes from men and women in the middle years of life. And to date, at least in social policy terms, no one pays attention to that.
There is hope.
They go unreckoned. Oh, absolutely is there hope. And there's a lot to do, and suicide is preventable. But you don't wait till the edge of the cliff. You start years earlier. And there are many, many things that we now know that could be done and that some people are starting to do.
All right. Dr. Eric Kane is co-director of the Center for the Study of Prevention of Suicide at the University of Rochester Medical School. He joined us from member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. Yvonne Smith is president of the Recovery Group. It's a mental health advocacy group based in Washington, and she was kind enough to join me here in our studios in Washington. Jim McNulty works with recovery programs at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and he joined us from member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.